in radio and television. It's RCA all the way. The Radio Corporation of America presents The Magic Key. Magic Key turns. 107 leading stations from coast to coast in the United States, in Canada, in Cuba, and in Hawaii are linked together to bring you this full hour of radio entertainment. Your host is the family of RCA, whose members include RCA Victor, RCA Institutes, Radio Marine, RCA Communications, and the National Broadcasting Company. Today, the Radio Corporation of America invites you to listen to the great Wagnerian tenor of the Metropolitan Opera Company, Lauritz Melchior. The distinguished American actress, Eva Le Gallienne, in a dramatic tribute commemorating the birthday of Shakespeare. Linton Wells, the Magic Key commentator, in a two-way interview with A.M. Purcell, managing editor of the Royal Gazette in Bermuda. And Frank Black, who opens the program as he conducts the augmented Magic Key orchestra in Glazunov's gay and brilliant Carnival Overture.
Thank you.
We are always happy to welcome, as an old friend, the great Wagnerian tenor Lauritz Melchior, leading member of the Metropolitan Opera Company and exclusive Victor recording artist. His appearance on our program today comes as the climax of one of the most amazing accomplishments in the annals of singing. On Good Friday, he sang the leading role in the complete five-hour performance of Parsifal. Yesterday, he sang the title role in the Metropolitan Opera presentation of Tristan und Isolde. And today, we bring him to you as a guest of the Magic Key, Lauritz Melchior. Lauritz Melchior sings Nur eine Waffe taugt, Parsifal's final song in the Hall of the Holy Grail at the close of Wagner's great festival drama. some of the most glorious music written by the great masters is appropriately performed on Easter Day. Yet it is music which will enrich your musical life at all times if you may hear it whenever you desire. And indeed you may, for that is your privilege when you are the owner of a library of Victor records. Once, owning such a library and a fine record-playing instrument was costly. Today, it makes no difference if you have no phonograph, for if you join the new Victor Record Society, you are provided at absolutely no extra cost with the RCA Victor Record Player, the famous instrument regularly listing for $14.95, which attaches to your radio and plays records through your loudspeaker. The Victor Record Society is a new organization whose membership of music lovers and record fans is growing daily. Its members are benefiting by extraordinary privileges never before offered to a music-loving public. Here is how you may become a member. Go to your nearest RCA Victor music dealer and enroll, paying a membership fee of $6. You purchase then $9 worth of Victor records, any records you choose. At absolutely no further cost, you receive the record player. Also, as a member, you become eligible for Victor Record dividends, which in value eventually equal the entire cost of your membership. A year's subscription to the Victor Record Society Review and many other privileges become yours. See your RCA Victor dealer tomorrow. The music is a scherzo from Mendelssohn's melodic accompaniment to A Midsummer Night's Dream. The occasion is a dramatic tribute to the memory of William Shakespeare, whose birthday will be observed this week throughout all the world. Our star is Eva LeGallien, founder of the Civic Repertory Theater and one of the most distinguished members of the American stage, who will appear in two scenes from the writings of the immortal bard. Eva LeGallien. From the first act of Shakespeare's comedy, The Merchant of Venice, Eva LeGallien has chosen first the scene in Portia's house between Portia and her waiting maid, Nerissa. We hear Miss LeGallien as Portia and Marion Evanson as Nerissa discussing confidentially the various suitors for Portia's hand.
Oh, by my troth, Nerissa, my little body is aweary of this great world.
You would be, sweet madam, if your miseries were in the same abundance as your good fortunes are. And yet, for aught I see, they are as sick that surfeit with too much as they that starve with nothing.
Good sentences and well pronounced.
They would be better if well followed.
If to do were as easy as to know what were good to do, chapels had been churches and poor men's cottages, princes' palaces. It is a good divine that follows his own instructions. I can easier teach 20 what were good to be done than be one of the 20 to follow mine own teaching. Ah, but this reasoning is not in the fashion to choose me a husband. Oh, me, the word choose. I may neither choose whom I would nor refuse whom I dislike. So is the will of a living daughter curbed by the will of a dead father. Is it not hard, Nerissa, that I cannot choose one nor refuse none?
Your father was ever virtuous, and holy men at their death have good inspirations. Therefore the lottery that he hath devised in these three chests of gold, silver, and lead, whereof who chooses his meaning chooses you, will no doubt never be chosen by any rightly, but one who you shall rightly love. But what warmth is there in your affection towards any of these princely suitors that are already come?
I pray thee overname them, and as thou namest them, I will describe them, and according to my description, level at my affection.
First, there is a Neapolitan prince.
Aye, that's a colt indeed, for he doth nothing but talk of his horse. And he makes it a great appropriation to his own good parts that he can shoe him himself. I am much afeard my lady, his mother, played false with a smith.
Then there is the county palatine.
He doth nothing but frown, as who should say, if you will not have me, choose. He hears merry tales and smiles not. I fear he will prove the weeping philosopher when he grows old, being so full of unmannerly sadness in his youth. I'd rather be married to a death's head with a bone in his mouth than to either of these. God defend me from these two.
How say you by the French lord, Monsieur Le Beau?
God made him, and therefore let him pass for a man. Oh, in truth, I know it is a sin to be a mocker, but he... he is every man and no man. If a throstle sing, he falls straight a capering. He will fence with his own shadow. If I should marry him, I should marry 20 husbands.
What say you then to Faulconbridge, the young baron of England?
You know, I say nothing to him, for he understands not me, nor I him. He hath neither Latin, French, nor Italian. He is a proper man's picture. But alas, who can converse with a dumb show? How oddly he is suited. I think he bought his doublet in Italy, his round hose in France, his bonnet in Germany, and his behavior everywhere.
Well, how like you the young German, the Duke of Saxony's nephew?
Very vilely in the morning when he is sober, and most vilely in the afternoon when he is drunk. When he is best, he is a little worse than a man, and when he is worst, he is little better than a beast. And the worst fall that ever fell, I hope I shall make shift to go without him.
If he should offer to choose and choose the right casket, you should refuse to perform your father's will if you should refuse to accept him.
Therefore, for fear of the worst, I pray thee set a deep glass of Rhenish wine on the contrary casket. For if the devil be within and that temptation without, I know he will choose it. I will do anything, Nerissa, ere I'll be married to a sponge.
You need not fear, lady, the having of any of these lords. They have acquainted me with their determinations, which is indeed to return to their home and to trouble you with no more suit unless you may be won by some other sort than your father's imposition depending on the caskets.
If I live to be as old as Sibylla, I will die as chaste as Diana unless I be obtained by the manner of my father's will. Oh, I'm glad this parcel of wooers are so reasonable, for there is not one among them but I dote on his very absence, and I pray God grant them a fair departure.
Do you not remember, lady, in your father's time, a Venetian, a scholar, and a soldier that came hither in company of the Marquis of Montferrat?
Yes. Yes, it was Bassanio, as I think he was so called.
True, madam. He, of all the men that ever my foolish eyes looked upon, was the best deserving of fair lady.
I remember him well, and I remember him worthy of thy praise. How now? What news?
The four strangers seek for you, madam, to take your leave. And there is a forerunner come from the fifth, the Prince of Morocco, who brings word the prince, his master, will be here tonight.
Oh, if I could bid the fifth welcome with so good a heart as I can bid the other four farewell, I should be glad of his approach. If he have the condition of a saint and the complexion of a devil, I had rather he should shrive me than wive me. Come, Nerissa. Sirrah, go before. Whilst we shut the gates upon one wooer, another knocks at the door.
In the present troubled world, Shakespeare's sentiments on mercy are indeed appropriate. Eva Le Gallienne offers Portia's famous Quality of Mercy speech from The Merchant of Venice.
The quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest, It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. His scepter shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute to God himself. And earthly power doth then show likest God's when mercy seasons justice. Therefore, though justice be thy plea, consider this, that in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. We do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy.
Climaxing this tribute to the anniversary of William Shakespeare's birthday, Frank Black and the Augmented Magic Key Orchestra bring us Mendelssohn's Overture to A Midsummer Night's Dream. Thank you.
Hear ye, hear ye, a letter from the town crier. Dear Magic Key, this is Woolcott writing in self-defense. On your program last Sunday, I lifted this old voice in quest of a book for which I had long been ransacking the second-hand stores, the 1895 volume of Harper's Young People. Surely there was one somewhere, forgotten on the shelf in the spare room closet. Would anybody like to sell? That was my question. The answer was yes, but the answer was also a chorus, a deafening chorus. By telephone calls that started before the broadcast was finished, by telegrams that fell on me like leaves in Vallombrosa, by letters still pouring in from every state in the Union, that long-lost friend was offered on every imaginable term of gift, sale, or barter. I wanted only one copy. Now I've got it. I've had it since Monday afternoon. The fiend who sold it to me put me in a spot. He stipulated that in return I could send whatever my conscience dictated to the baby's hospital. After some quibbling, my conscience dictated $25. You may recall I was sure I'd never find this book in so heedless and hurried a city as New York. Therefore, I'm in duty bound to report that I did. This copy, now deep, came to light in a house only one block away from the hotel where I was stopping for the night. This experience has been instructive. I now know how to find Captain Kidd's buried treasure. I shall just ask for it on the Magic Key. Signed, Alexander Woolcott.
From the date of its beginning, 11 years ago, the National Broadcasting Company has pioneered in bringing to your loudspeaker outstanding programs that have become milestones in the progress of radio. The first coast-to-coast program, the first program from a foreign land, the first symphonic concert, the first broadcast direct from an opera house, radio's first full-sized major symphony orchestra. These are just a few of the radio firsts which go to make up the NBC tradition, which says that you, the listener, must be interested and entertained by the best programs that radio has to offer. Listen for the familiar NBC chimes, your signal for fine radio entertainment. The Magic Key turns, opening the door to a world of entertainment. Following our presentation of Eva Le Gallienne in a dramatic tribute commemorating the birthday of Shakespeare, we now invite you to listen to Linton Wells, our Magic Key commentator, in a two-way talk with A.M. Purcell, managing editor of the Royal Gazette in Bermuda, a return appearance of Lauritz Melchior, and Frank Black conducting the Magic Key Orchestra. Carillon from Bizet's L'Alésienne suite fills the air with the mellow tones of orchestral bells as Frank Black conducts the augmented Magic Key Orchestra.
800 miles southeast of New York are those treasure islands of the North Atlantic, the Bermudas, birthplace of most of our lovely and symbolic Easter lilies. Appropriately, our commentator, Linton Wells, today talks with A.M. Purcell, managing editor of the Royal Gazette in Hamilton, Bermuda. The magic key turns to Linton Wells.
Easter greetings, Mr. Purcell.
The same to you all, Mr. Wells.
We're told that most of our symbolic Easter lilies had their origin in the Bermudas. How did the culture of lilies happen to center in Bermuda, Mr. Purcell?
Bermuda is largely indebted to a fine American soldier, General Hastings, of Civil War fame, for the cultivation of lilies in Bermuda. He was one of the first Americans to buy a beautiful Bermuda home, and he spent much time cultivating and marketing our lilies.
By the way, can you tell us why the lily is a symbol of Easter?
Yes, Mr. Wells. Long before the Christian era, Easter, a purely Saxon word, was considered the period of rebirth, and the lily, most beautiful of all flowers, was regarded as the symbol of purity. As such, it figures in all the early religious pictures. By the way, experiments are now being conducted, and shortly it may be possible to supply you with lilies at Christmas. And by the way, Mr. Wells, you may be interested in another experiment being carried out this very week. Several of our lily growers, instead of cutting and exporting all their lilies before Easter, have consented to let some lilies remain in the fields so that our visitors arriving at Easter might see them in bloom. One such field of over 7 acres contains more than a million blooms.
That's very interesting, and that field must look magnificent. And now, what do lilies mean to your colony in the way of employment and revenue?
It is difficult to estimate exactly, for in addition to the commercial exportation, thousands of visitors carry away lilies with them. And in addition, the bulbs are taken up in July and August and exported to nurserymen in America, Canada, and England. The revenue is much greater than that stated in official records, since these refer only to shipments.
That's quite a worthwhile industry, isn't it? I suppose most of your lilies are shipped by airplane.
The advent of the airplane and the airmail service has considerably augmented the shipment by steamer, Mr. Wells. And as a matter of fact, I sent an armload of Bermuda lilies to the Magic Key staff by the Pan America Clipper just a few hours ago.
Well, that was thoughtful of you, Mr. Purcell, and our thanks for doing it. We'll be on the lookout for them. Now let's turn from the sublime to the ridiculous. Your beautiful islands are also well known for a delectable vegetable. Without it, the festive American hamburger is characterless. I refer, of course, to the savory Bermuda onion. What role does it play in the Bermuda economy?
I'm sorry to say, Mr. Wells, that though our onion is just as delectable as ever, the American market is more or less closed to us. But as visitors insist on local fresh vegetables whilst here, the local market has thereby increased. Formerly, a Mudian had to go to New York to taste one of his own native onions.
Well, while we're on the subject of economy, I notice Bermuda's exports are about one-fifth her imports. How do your 30,000 residents manage to keep solvent with such adverse trade conditions?
Oh, we keep solvent by welcoming the stranger. A yearly influx of over 80,000 visitors enables us to keep the wolf from the door. And by the way, Mr. Wells, we have no taxes or taxes.
What a paradise.
But since we have to import all our merchandise, chiefly from America, a big revenue is necessary. Now that Bermuda is a suburb of New York, this is fortunately possible.
Yes, now that Bermuda is practically in New York's front yard, it's only natural that tourists should flock down there to enjoy your climate and natural beauty.
Talking of our natural beauty, Mr. Wells, did you ever hear of Mark Twain's famous description of us? Americans, when they die, go to heaven. But most of them stop at Bermuda on the way and think they've arrived already.
That's quite an apt description. In passing, when is the transatlantic air service starting?
Well, the best opinion suggests next year, with preliminary flights in the meantime.
The Bermudas are fortunate to occupy such a strategic position in mid-Atlantic. As a matter of interest, I presume Great Britain continues to maintain a strong garrison there besides an adequate naval force.
Changes in modern warfare have altered conditions. We have a smaller military garrison than formerly, but a larger naval squadron. And also, the Royal Air Force is now active here. But our secure garrison is the proximity of friendly America.
Well, all Americans should be glad to know that Bermuda is protected by her British cousins rather than by someone less friendly. Now, thank you, Mr. Purcell, for the lilies and the interview. You'll also be interested to know that some lilies arrived from you just the other day at Mr. Purcell on Good Friday, to be exact. Thank you very much.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Mr. Wells. Cheerio.
Cheerio, Mr. Purcell.
You've just heard a two-way interview between Linton Wells in New York and A.M. Purcell, managing editor of the Royal Gazette in Hamilton, Bermuda. Within a few hours, Linton Wells, the Magic Key's roving commentator, will board a plane to begin a flying tour which will take him during the next 4 months throughout the length and breadth of Central and South America and the West Indies. On May 8th, Mr. Wells will speak to you from Managua, Nicaragua, in the first of a series of on-the-spot reports from our neighbor republics to the south.
Once again on today's program, we are pleased to present Lauritz Melchior, leading Metropolitan Opera Company tenor and exclusive Victor recording artist. Mr. Melchior. Lauritz Melchior sings the most renowned aria from Richard Wagner's opera Die Meistersinger, Walter's Prize Song.
Oh,
Eugene Ormandy, leader of Philadelphia's famed symphony orchestra. We feel honored, therefore, when Mr. Ormandy has this to say. I have never before heard a radio which compares with the new RCA Victor symphony radio in the amazing faithfulness of its performance. It is magnificent. But Eugene Ormandy is not alone in this opinion. Yasha Heifetz, world-renowned violinist, Sergei Koussevitzky, famous conductor of the Boston Symphony, Walter Damrosch, dean of American symphony leaders, concur in equally glowing tributes. Dance band leaders like Guy Lombardo and Tommy Dorsey are also lavish in their praise. To deserve this outpouring of enthusiasm, the RCA Victor Symphony Radio must be something different. It is different. It is the RCA Victor Laboratory's answer to a request for an instrument with tone unsurpassed. This is not a distance-getting radio. It has no short wave. It is recommended only for metropolitan areas where high-quality broadcasting stations are within a distance of 100 miles. But if you are located in such a metropolitan area, and if you are interested in the finest tone you ever heard from a radio, the RCA Victor Symphony Radio is the radio for you. It has RCA Victor electric tuning. Push a button, there's your station. It is housed in an exquisite cabinet, a beautifully wrought 18th century design. The price, $125 FOB Camden, New Jersey. And if you attach an RCA Victor record player, the RCA Victor Symphony Radio will enable you to hear both records and radio programs with the quality of a high-priced phonograph radio and at less than half the cost. See your RCA Victor dealer.
Thank you.
Frank Black and the Magic Key Orchestra have just played the impressive finale to Dvorak's New World Symphony.
Have you ordered your copy of the NBC Symphony book? Music lovers everywhere assure us this is a worthwhile addition to their libraries. Send $1 to the station and mark your envelope, NBC Symphony Book.
The members of the family of RCA, RCA Victor, RCA Institutes, Radio Marine, RCA Communications, and the National Broadcasting Company invite you to tune in again at this same time next Sunday for another full hour of radio entertainment, which will come to you direct from the Music Hall in Cincinnati, Ohio. At that time, you will hear the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Eugene Goossens, with Marjorie Lawrence, soprano of the Metropolitan Opera Company, as soloist. Cross speaking for all the services of the Radio Corporation of America.
and Ben Grauer saying that in radio and television, it's RCA all the way.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.